Welcome back to Poking Holes in Blinders. My name is Colin Fallenweider, and with me as always is Dr. Brian Height. In today's episode, we discuss the book Range, written by David Epstein. We also talk about the death penalty. Should we have it? Should we not have it? And throwing yourself downstairs. How do we just jump into death penalty? How do you lead into that, huh? Hey, death penalty thoughts.
You know, see, I was just going to ask you what's been going on since the last time we talked. I wasn't going to jump into the death penalty. Why you got to be so, why are you so excited to talk about? Yeah, let's lead into stuff, man. How are you?
I am doing great. Doing great. Keeping real busy at work. Things that just keep on adding up. It's like, oh, you know what? We kind of got a mellow week. And then all of a sudden, like, no, we got to hire 8 more people for tomorrow. But okay, let's find 8 people. That's kind of fun. And then like, whoo, we got past that. And it's like, oh no, we're not done. We actually need to hire 7 more people next week. Like the end of next week? No, beginning. It's like, all right, well, let's try to figure that out over the weekend. But it is always just about problem solving. That is one of the reasons why I love being a stunt man and being a stunt coordinator, because you get thrown all these different things and all you have to do is find solutions to it. Let's figure out how to make this work. And I just love that problem solving aspect of my job.
That's interesting because it goes to that book that you and I both read and really enjoyed, Range. It's like you're describing a wicked environment. Like that book is very much about the idea that having broad experiences is extremely helpful, if not essential, for being able to solve problems as well as we can in a wicked world, and as opposed to a kind world. He distinguished between the two, a kind world being one where there are many constraints. Those constraints don't change. Things are the same from time to time to time. Feedback that you get today will be applicable tomorrow. And a wicked world is the opposite of that. It's what you described. It's showing up on set and it might be the same gag. Maybe you did a stair fall on one show and there's a stair fall on this show, but it can be completely different, you know, different actors. Maybe they're doubling. Maybe the stairs are concrete versus wood, steep versus, you know, not. So it's really interesting when you talk about problem solving and the fun that you have with it. And what I know of you, of what your background is and how broad and wide your range of activities has been, it's not surprising, given David Epstein's perspective, that you would enjoy and be good at that problem solving in those wicked types of environments.
I always thought I was a jack of all, master of none. Maybe we should get a little background on the book Range. The book is called Range. It is Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. It's by David Epstein. And I think we both just finished it last week. It's such an amazing book. And it had comparisons between specialists like Tiger Woods and generalists, if you didn't know this, about Roger Federer, and how they both were able to be successful in their sports. And Tiger Woods had a very specialized, deliberate learning right off the bat. He had a club in his hand when he was 2. He was already shooting like his father when he was 5 and just dominated in the sport. Whereas Roger Federer, who is also a dominant force in tennis, but he had such a wide variety of skills. And the thing that David Epstein was proposing is that while specialists are important, and you were saying in a kind environment where you know what the outcome is, you know what the rules are, but the world we live in is a wicked environment and there's so many things that change and you have to have the outside the box thinking to be able to solve real world problems that we've never encountered before. He did say that the whole quote of that is, a jack of all is a master of none, but oftentimes better than a master of one. So back to being a jack, I always had trepidation that I was never really the best at one thing. I always wish that I was at least a master of one, but really I was like a B team, top of the B team, end of the A team in any sport that I played. But I played a lot of different sports, and throughout my life, I've had a lot of different pursuits. The biggest was being a gymnast. But beyond that, I'm a skier. I was a dance major for a little bit. I've done acting stuff. I really enjoy math. I was a math major for half a semester. And I think with such a generalist experience that now I feel that all of those broad scope of training and experience has really helped me thrive in being a stuntman, because all these things keep coming at us and it's different situations, but it's all about problem solving. And like you said, with the stairs, and hey, you want to go head over heels, or you want to go sideways, or you just want to bounce once on the way down? It's like, how are we going to figure that out? I don't think I've ever just thrown myself downstairs. Actually, that's a lie. I have thrown myself downstairs. I lived in the basement and I used to just practice falling down the stairs to get to my room instead of walking.
Oh, you were in high school when you did that?
Yeah.
I guess that's a little bit better. A friend of mine that you and I both know, when we were roommates just starting out in stunts, we used to have stair falling contests in our apartment. Landlord did not like that, but that's what we did.
How does that work?
I don't know. You fall down the stairs and whoever happens to be standing around judges how well you did.
You're like, that was a lame stair fall, you know, when you just kind of trickle down.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes they are. You get stuck halfway down, or maybe you slide down some of them instead of really roll. Anyway, that's a ridiculous discussion. The point is that, yes, the stunts in general. And in fact, you know, a question that I get asked a lot, and you probably do too, when people find out that you do stunts is, what's your specialty? And I always answer, I don't have a specialty. I don't know that I would have made a living if I just had a specialty, if there was just one thing that I did. And there are some guys out there who are exceptionally good on a motorcycle, or exceptionally good in a car, or exceptionally good with fire. They've just spent years and years and years training these different things. But even those guys that come into my mind when I think about that are just good all around stunt people. I've seen them in other situations too, not just in a car, not just in a motorcycle or dealing with fire. They do other things as well. And I think that that broad exposure to all of the different types of gags under all different types of situations is really valuable and does allow people to be in these volatile, unpredictable environments and be able to solve problems real time in the moment much more effectively than they could if they just were an expert in a thing.
One thing that's interesting about that is there are stunt people that are just experts in the one thing, and they may be the best at that. But as David Epstein pointed out in the book, like, their top end is limiting, or is limited. Say it's car work. Maybe say it's cannons. A cannon is when you have a cannon in your car and you hit it and it rolls over. You guys have all seen it in films.
Yeah. Think about it like you have a telephone pole shoved up in the car and then an explosion blows the telephone pole out through the bottom and that flips the car.
So if that's their specialty, there's not a lot of opportunity for that. It comes around from time to time. But if you're completely specialized in a single thing, then 80% of stunt work is just fighting and falling down. So you get that little 2% of all jobs out there that are a cannon. At least there's a bunch of car work that does happen, but that's still also a small percentage of the work that we do. Most of it is fighting and falling down. And so you'd want to be a generalist to be able to do the majority of the work. Otherwise, you're limiting your career options.
Yeah. And it can make things safer. Like Epstein pointed out too, the specialists, they tend to get very deep into their subject matter. Obviously, they're specializing in it, but they're very, very good with procedure. So they learn the nuances of their little sliver of the world and all the things that go along with that. And they understand the procedures and they can replicate that and they understand that world. But as soon as things go outside of that one little area, because of that specialization, they tend to only look through things through that one lens, and that can limit them in terms of their understanding of what else is happening. There is certainly a place, and he made a very good case for a place for specialists, that a blend of specialists and generalists can be a beneficial thing. But it really does come down to the environment that you find yourself in. If you are a chess player, or even to a large extent, like in the fire profession, like fire people, sometimes in police, I dealt with it when I was working with the military. They have what are called TTPs, tactics, techniques, procedures. And these are the rules. These are the steps that you go through. And faced with this situation, these are the things that you do. And those can be helpful, but they can also be limited. If that's your specialty, if that's your thing, and you only have this procedure to follow, deviating from that procedure becomes very difficult And sometimes the environments you go into aren't what you thought you were going into. And it's something that I know the military struggled with, particularly when the Iraq war started and so many soldiers were clearing rooms, clearing buildings. That's what they were doing. They never knew what they were going to go into in the building. They had a TTP for clearing rooms. It was written out in their battle drill six, I think it is. But once you actually went in the door, you had to just react to what was happening. And that's still how it is right now in those same situations. So the specialists, I absolutely believe, have a place. But the more broadly we can experience situations, and he talked about it in terms of music, he talked about it in terms of education. I loved the stories in the later chapters, like about problems with NASA and NASA being a very procedure, step-by-step organization that just is filled with silos of specialists where nobody really crosses those boundaries and the problems that that caused. I don't know. It's a very interesting book.
It really is. And about the NASA thing, he was saying that because of their such a procedural based organization, that if you didn't have facts or statistics to back up what you're saying, then you might as well not say it. As opposed to what happened with the Challenger is there was some blowback and some O-rings that got inside one of the boosters, and it happened twice out of 17 launches or something like that. There was an occurrence that happened twice, and when they brought it up, but they were asked about more data for it, it's like they don't have it. It was just kind of a feeling that they got this happened twice in these circumstances. In retrospect, those were the really important ones that if they would have been able to take that in consideration, that they probably wouldn't have launched and they probably would have figured out what the problem was. But since there wasn't enough data, the procedures of NASA created an environment when you can't say things without having backup.
Yeah.
Also about the book is I loved his analogy between frogs and birds, where frogs were the specialist and birds were the generalist, and the need of both. That we need both the frogs in the dirt, getting all the details in a certain pursuit. And then you need the birds that had kind of have a big general view of the whole landscape. I always thought that was a nice analogy. The way our society is what Epstein was saying, is that we are more entrenched in pushing the frogs, the early start, the early development. And he was saying that the statistics is kind of counterintuitive. Like, am I falling behind because I'm being so general? However, he was saying the data actually shows that you're not.
Yeah. And not only not falling behind, I was watching a video of him. I don't know if it was a TED talk or there was a very interesting interview he did with Malcolm Gladwell. And what's interesting about it is that Malcolm Gladwell is the person who put forth the 10,000 hours of practice theory. That you need 10,000 hours of deliberate practice, focused practice with feedback in order to develop specialization in an area, and that that's a desirable thing. And David Epstein and Malcolm Gladwell ended up linking up somewhere along the line. I think Epstein criticized something that Gladwell wrote, and then Gladwell wrote something back to him, and then they ended up debating each other. And at the end of the day, it was so cool to listen to Malcolm Gladwell say this. He said, yeah, you convinced me. I started out just having this discussion. He said, when you get attacked, you should just love the other person because what else is there to do? I don't know. It's an interesting take. But the point was that he started out just sort of placating Epstein and then ended up being convinced by his argument. And so now they're both on the same page. If you listen to Gladwell talk about what kids especially should do in sport and music, et cetera, it's don't specialize. Have a broad range of what Epstein called sampling stage of trying out this instrument and then another instrument, this sport, that sport, another sport, whatever activities you're talking about. But I thought that was great that they got together and Gladwell had his mind changed. He had his mind open enough to listen to an argument and he just right there in front of everybody, just let him know, yeah, I was wrong. He's right. That makes more sense. Let's go that way. Thought it was terrific.
That's so hard as a parent, though. I don't need my kids to play a certain sport. I don't. But I just wanted to play catch with them, like baseball catch. And they were so not interested in it. Really, the idea was, I think there's a benefit in being in sports and team sports because of the camaraderie, because of the discipline, because of you know, the coach and the hierarchy. I just think there's a benefit in being in team sports. So I was trying to get my kids into team sports. Like, we did rugby with my son when he was a kid. He didn't really enjoy it. We've dabbled in soccer. I thought maybe if I gave them opportunity to play baseball, they'd get interested in that. And they wouldn't do it. I actually had a chore. I'm like, if you play baseball with me, throw the ball for 5 minutes, I'll give you $2. And they took me up on it once, and then it's not their thing. But as a parent, I had internal conflict that are they falling behind if they ever choose to do any of these sports? It turns out after range, it actually put my mind at ease and say, no, what we're doing is if they're not interested, that's fine, because we're just keep on giving them the opportunities to pursue other things and to have that sampling period. The book really helped me put my mind at ease. I'm like, okay, we're doing all right. But as a parent, you're like, oh my gosh, are they falling behind? Do we need to do that head start thing? You know, the early development, because that's where our mentality as a society has been with the 10,000 hours. That's, everyone knows that theory. And so it's pretty amazing that Epstein was able to change the mind of the person who proposed that theory. Like, that's huge for that to happen.
It does seem to make sense that if you do get a head start, if you're ahead of everybody early, then you should be on the trajectory to stay ahead. And his point is research just doesn't show that people eventually catch up. Or in the case of music and sport too, injury or burnout can happen. And just a loss of motivation, and people just stop doing whatever it is that they were doing. Whereas if they had the chance to sample a little bit, to bounce from whatever to whatever, and finally land on something that they really love, then they're doing it because they really love it. And they'll sustain. And at that point, then they begin to specialize and they begin to have more deliberate practice. Really was eye-opening. And if you get the chance to watch I forget what it's called, but David Epstein, Malcolm Gladwell, it's on YouTube. You can watch it. It's just great to hear Malcolm Gladwell just come right straight out and say, yeah, you changed my mind. Think your idea is great.
So I watched that TED Talk with David Epstein, that it was 14 minutes that really summarized his whole book. And he hit so many points in that, which I thought were pretty amazing. He's not just talking about sports. When he was talking about, say, college grads or early professionals, that the ones that did have a head start make more money right off the bat. And the others that have more of a later specialization don't make the money right off the bat. But then in time, the head starters would get burnout or have dissatisfaction with their jobs, and they would end up falling off the curve, whereas the later specialists end up making more money and they're more successful later in life. I think that's what it's really talking about. It's not just a finite period of the top of the top. Like, Tiger Woods was the top, but Roger Federer had such domination in his sport because of his wide range. I went back to sports. I didn't mean to do that.
You did, but the point with Tiger Woods is also that his specialization allowed him to succeed and maintain that success largely, according to Epstein, because it's a kind environment in which he operates. It's a golf environment where, again, in sports psychology terms, it's what's called a closed skill, meaning that you just repeat the same skill and you try to perfect the same movements. It's the same thing with gymnastics routines or dance routines or ice skating routines. These are closed skills, as opposed to open skills, which is basketball, not free throws. That would be a closed skill, but the actual playing in the middle of the court. Soccer, same thing. Those are open skills where we just have to react to a dynamic environment. Yes, Tiger, with this deliberate practice for years and years and years, worked out very well because he was operating within a kind environment. Same thing with the chess masters. His point with the chess masters was that they get very, very, very good at pattern recognition. They understand what the patterns on the board mean. They've seen them so many times and they know how to operate within them because that's a procedural task that they've learned through years and years of practice. But in wicked environments like stunts and others, which I'll get to in a minute, that's when the generalization, that's when the broader perspective comes in. And we started this talking about problem solving with stunts. And I want to go back to that because that was something I also found interesting in this book when he was talking about, and I don't remember the organization's name, but the organization that basically crowdsourced problems for people. These are problems that the smartest people in the environment, all of the specialists that they had, PhDs coming out the ears, they couldn't solve these problems. In some case, for 30 years, there was a NASA problem that NASA had been working on for 30 years. And these people just put it out to the world. And people, just regular people with regular jobs who just had broad interests and had read in a lot of areas, suggested some solutions. I thought one was great. It was, you know, when they skim the oil out of the water and it goes into whatever container it is, they have problems getting the oil out of the container. And that stumped a bunch of people until this chemist from Illinois, while waiting for a plane, started thinking about the problem. And he started by thinking about it in terms of chemistry, naturally, but he shifted from that. And for whatever reason, his mind went to a slushy and how thick the slushy was and swirling it around with a straw. And then from there, it went to a strategy that concrete people use. He had worked with concrete when he was younger, and it's using a rod attached to an engine so that it vibrates to loosen up the concrete. And he put the slushy idea together with the concrete memory, and voila, there was a solution to this problem that had stumped so many people for so long. There are many, many things like that where it just shows that sometimes being too close to the information, too immersed in the information, can blind us to all of the other possibilities that might exist. Whereas if we have these other broad perspectives, these other areas that we can draw from, similar to, I believe it was Kepler, he was talking about, used metaphor. So when he was thinking about Mars going around the sun, he was thinking about a boat or a whirlpool, or how, you know, just different things that he was familiar with in his environment and applying them to this unique problem. That's something that's much easier to do if we have those broad experiences.
I really did love that book. It was really good. It just makes me feel better about myself not really being a master of anything. We had another thing that we wanted to discuss today. We wanted to talk about the death penalty a little bit. And I did some research on the death penalty, on how many nations in the world actually still have it. There are 55 nations out of 195 that still have the death penalty. Also, I found that in Russia in 1996, Boris Yeltsin put a moratorium on capital punishment. I just thought it's such a fascinating thing that it seems like the nations of the world are going away from it. And is there a benefit of having the death penalty, or is it better off to penalize criminals with life in prison? What do you think?
Or something else. I don't know. There are many options. To me, the question that you asked, I mean, I would just ask you back. You said, is it better? What is better? In other words, how do you define good? And by that, I mean, what is the purpose of the death penalty? What are you trying to achieve?
Like me personally?
I mean, in general, why do you think the death penalty exists?
I don't really know quite how I feel on the subject, like where I place my feelings. It would seem to me that the theory of the death penalty is to subvert criminal activities. When there are violent crimes that are so bad that the consequence is that you forfeit your life, but does it work? Is it something that is successful in subverting criminal acts? I don't know.
If I'm understanding you right, the purpose of the death penalty for you is to prevent crime.
I would think so.
That's its purpose?
Well, I mean, and also to punish those that commit certain crimes. Like I said, I'm not one way or the other on it, but I would say to have the death penalty, that's what it's trying to accomplish.
Okay. So let's go with the second one. So you said to punish the person. How is the death penalty punishing that person?
They forfeit their life, I guess.
Yes. And this is the interesting thing, because I'm with you. I asked this question. Honestly, I don't know what the point of the death penalty is, but to know whether you're for it or against it, you really have to pick one, because there could be many. One is, like you said, to prevent crime. It's just a preventative measure. It's just a threat of what could happen. So you shouldn't do this stuff because this bad thing might happen to you. That's one purpose. Another is what you said before, too, the punishing other person, like the person who engaged in the crime. But my question is, it's again honest, how is the death penalty punishing that person? Because that person will be dead. They won't know that they've been punished. The purpose of punishment is to extinguish behavior. And in this case, for sure, you're going to extinguish the behavior because you're extinguishing the person. But they won't know. It's not like punishing the way that we think about it, which is I'm going to punish my child this time so that they'll know the next time they get into this situation that they shouldn't do what they did this time. That's not the case with the death penalty because the person doesn't have the opportunity to do the bad thing again. So I don't know. You see what I'm saying? Like, it gets confusing. Is killing somebody actually punishing them if they're dead and they don't know that they're punished? They no longer exist. Christians specifically, we'll just talk about them, believe that life continues after death. So if somebody is executed, they still have a soul and that soul is going somewhere. And the Christians believe if you've done something bad, if you've committed the sin, well, it's not really what they believe, because this is where it also gets complicated, is that sometimes death penalty people are like, I'm going to kill them because then they'll go to hell. But if the person is truly a Christian and they believe in Christ, then they are forgiven for whatever they do on a spiritual level. And so even though they've killed this person and society has killed them, they will still go to heaven. So in that sense, it's like the opposite of punishment. You're sending the person to paradise. It's like Islam. If you go blow yourself up, then you get to go to paradise and have your virgins and whatever else they promise. I'm not sure what.
I've heard that before. If you blow yourself up and then you go to heaven and there's 72 virgins, like that's a real thing that is in the Quran.
Yeah.
Why not 73 or 60? With most religions, it's just such a metaphor for guidance, as opposed to the actuality of 72 virgins waiting for you. But if we're talking about the death penalty in religion, maybe one of the proponents of a religious person that believes in the death penalty, that they will be punished beyond the grave. Maybe that's why they have strong feelings of keeping the death penalty. What about the other side? What about people that believe totally against the death penalty, away from the eye for an eye mentality? Like, I wonder what their strongest arguments for no death penalty are.
Well, I mean, the eye for the eye is interesting because that's something that Jesus directly talked about in, I want to say Matthew, but I might be wrong about that, in the Sermon on the Mount. Like, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, but I say to you, like, there's a whole series of those. And that's when Jesus turned the other cheek. Jesus flips the Old Testament way of looking at things. And even an eye for an eye, if you go back in history, this is going to be stupid, nerdy, but
I love your nerdiness.
Eye for an eye. People usually look at that as just retribution. So I'm going to give you do this to me, I'm going to do this to you. Like, it's an eye for an eye. That's what it is. That's what it's saying. And it sort of is saying that. But what I've read about the intent of that was an eye for an eye, not an eye for a scratch, where the retribution that you provide is equal to the harm that was done to you. Whereas what had been done in that point in history was, if you do something that rates a 2 on a scale of 1 to 10 to me, I'm going to do it 11 to you. And so the Old Testament was actually reining it in a little bit, trying to get people to just look, if he did this to you, then you can do this, but not more than that. And Jesus said, not even that. Like, that's not even what you do. If somebody does something to you, you turn the other cheek and you say, you know what? You want to hit this one? You can hit the other one too. So this idea of religion backing up retribution, it doesn't really, in terms of the intent, the way I understand and read those documents, even that's hard to justify in my mind. Just to stick with, because I want to move to the other direction that you asked in a minute of what, you know, what about those who don't believe that the death penalty should happen? People who do believe in the death penalty, again, why? Is it preventative? Is it punishment? And this is a philosophical thing that I think is important too. Why should retribution be so important? Or is it so important? What do you think? If somebody does something wrong, do they deserve something wrong done to them?
I think it's important to take the responsibility for your actions. So say you break the law, there should be some consequence. I believe that. I think one of the problems for me in society is people always trying to get out of the consequences of what they do, whether it's on a personal level or trying to defer. It's like, well, you know, I did that, but these were the reasons, or, you know, trying to skirt out of the responsibility of it. So I do believe in consequences. But like you said, retribution consequences, eye for the eye, like the punishment should be equal to the crime. That's a way of thinking about it. Then if someone kills someone, then they should be killed. But is that the best way of pursuing, I don't know, pursuing humanity's consequences, humanity's punishments?
Well, the question that I would ask in that situation is, why is it bad that somebody killed somebody? Like, why do we care?
Because that someone's life is gone. They don't get to live their life. They don't get to live their life in freedom and happiness, and they don't get to have their pursuits.
Yeah. So life is valuable to us. We yes. value life. We yes. think life is important.
Yes.
And so because we think life is so important, the way that we're going to help ensure that life stays important is we're going to take life from people.
I see what you're saying.
See where I'm going with that? Yeah. That's a little bit off, I think. I don't know.
It is a little off.
Like, we think life is so precious that we're going to take it. As a society, we're sanctioning that as from the government, from the top. It doesn't make sense.
That is an amazing perspective argument that you just proposed. I would also say that there's a financial implication. What's the overall cost value between life in prison or someone on death row? Is that part of the argument too? Or is that just peripheral arguments to try to justify the beliefs on whether we feel like we should kill someone or not?
I don't know. I mean, I think that somebody could probably bring in the financial argument and have that be valid. But if what truly matters, if what we're talking about is how important life is, how important we consider life to be as a society, how much value we place on life, do finances at some point trump the importance of life? Maybe.
Does it?
Maybe in some people's mind it does.
Yeah. Is it a way to combat overcrowding in prisons? This person committed this crime. We shouldn't kill them. However, the prisons are way overcrowded, and therefore maybe we can free up some bed space. It's such a fucked up mentality, right?
Well, yeah, but it goes the other way too. It's interesting. I just read an article about the overcrowding of jails and how packed they are with mentally unstable people and addicts. And one proposition that was put out there, I think it was the Houston jail that was focused on. It was a New York Times article. But one proposition that was out there is for people who had already been in jail for 9 months and had committed a crime, that the sentencing for that crime would surely not be longer than 9 months, then you can just let them out of jail. Because what they're doing in jail, they're waiting for their case to come up. They're waiting to get sentenced. And when the sentencing would happen, it would be you get this amount of time minus time served. And so what the argument is they've already served the amount of time that they would get in the sentence. So let's just let them out. One of the arguments against that was that the victims deserved justice. So it wasn't even about the person being punished. It wasn't about removing somebody dangerous from society. It wasn't about doing something that is likely to result in different behavior from that individual the next time they find themselves in similar circumstances. It was just simply they were keeping these people in jail so that the victims would be happy, feel like justice had happened. I'm not really sure, but that was one of the arguments.
I wonder if we have a skewed view of justice, like what that actually means. Because if you look at it, if keeping the person in prison is for justice for the victims, but they're in there for a crime that the maximum sentence is already expired, they've already done the maximum sentence, then how is justice not served by letting them out? I guess if you let them out, then there would be no official verdict, like no guilty verdict or not guilty verdict on the books.
Yeah, and we here in the United States imprison a way higher percentage of our population than any other industrialized nation on this globe. Like, not by a little bit, by a lot. And the reason why that is, I don't know what it is, but it's an interesting discussion to have about why in the world we have chosen as this country that prides itself on freedom and independence and uses those terms as ways to define itself. How in the world are we justifying locking up such a large percentage of our population? I don't know.
It goes back to the system. If we believe in the system that we already have of crimes and punishment, then we're adhering to that system that's already been established, as opposed to trying to figure out a better way or new system that allows actually more freedom without detrimenting people's liberties.
Yeah, and you're right. It comes down to a change of values, what we think is important. Because right now, think about the words that we use, the justice system, the penal system. It's a penalty. Like, there's a whole system around this penalty. It's a penalty. The death penalty. It's around when people do something wrong, we need to impose this penalty upon them. It's trying to motivate through punishment. And decades of research, at least decades of research, and philosophers for hundreds of years have known that that approach is absolutely not the best one. B.F. Skinner wrote a great, he's known for operant conditioning in behaviorism with the Skinner box. You might have heard it with the pigeons. They tap the thing however many times and they get a reward. But he also wrote a novel, a fiction book. It's a utopian kind of, well, depending on your perspective, utopian book on how behaviorism can be implemented within a whole society to the benefit of everybody involved. It's a really interesting book. But the point is that for years and years and years, people have known that setting up a system around punishment to create motivation in people is just not the most effective way of doing things. But that's what our system is. It's right there in the name, the penal system. So it would require a change of values. We have to start valuing rehabilitation over punishment. We have to start valuing integration in society rather than isolation from society. When people commit these crimes, we have to look at it as an opportunity to enhance and help an individual who went off the path somewhere, as opposed to harming that individual to whatever degree we believe he or she harmed somebody else. It would require a huge shift in values that I don't know how we could bring that about. How can we make that happen? Or do you see a different way of shifting things in the way that you're talking about? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, the system is set up so that this is what we're going to get and we just need a new system. But how do we get that? What's required?
I don't know, dude. Like I said, I think our actions incur responsibility for the results of those actions. This is the way we've grown up in a system that is crime and punishment. And I don't know how to change that. It's like the global consciousness. What gives you the right to just take something from someone else? Like all of the Amazon thievery people, they follow an Amazon truck, it drops it off, you go porch pirates. All those people, like, how do you justify that to yourself? I just don't understand the mindset. It's like, I didn't pay for that. It's right there. I'll just go ahead and take it because I deserve it because I followed an Amazon truck. I don't understand people's mindset about that. Another thing that I don't understand people's mindset about, and maybe it does have to do with our punishment mentality, is death threats. What is the purpose of death threats? Like when you call someone and say, hey, you're going to die. It's almost the same mentality as the death penalty. You're trying to subvert some behavior in some form by telling someone that you're going to kill them for that behavior. That's a death threat. And that's the same as the death penalty.
You know, it's what's funny is that you put those things together and I didn't know where you were going with it when you first started talking about it. But what occurred to me is, yeah, there is a big similarity between a death threat, which is a crime, and the death penalty, which is our law. They're the exact same thing for the exact same purpose, to prevent people's behavior. If I threaten you, Colin, you better not do this or I'm going to kill you. Or Colin, you better do this or I'm going to kill you. That's the same thing the law is saying. Don't do this or we'll kill you. You better do this or we'll kill you. It is. It's the same thing. But one is sanctified in law and the other is a crime.
It's a crime. Do you think people that are for the death penalty are also for death threats? Do they go hand in hand? Because it's the same mentality, right?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I would say, yeah. It's like, hey, I'm totally okay with the death penalty. Totally okay. Because this person did something and they should die for that. Oh, this person's doing something that I don't like. You know what? I'm just going to go ahead and threaten their life. Hey, stop doing that or I'm going to kill you.
Well, it's funny. I mean, the death threat, it's an extreme version of a punishment. From a theoretical standpoint, in terms of motivation, it works the exact same way as any other threat of punishment. Like a kid at a pool. If you run by the pool, then I'm going to make you come sit down. That's a punishment for a behavior. And the whole point is I'm going to threaten you with something that you don't like so that you'll stop doing this thing I don't want you to do. That's the point. And there are gradations right on a death threat. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to threaten you with death. If you do this thing, then I will kill you. The ultimate punishment, except for what I said earlier, which I don't know that it is the ultimate punishment because people are dead. And again, this totally depends on your beliefs about the afterlife, if one exists, if it doesn't exist, if humans have souls, if they don't have souls. But if you believe that once you die, you are not going to be the same person or the same entity that you are right now, then punishment makes no sense, except to the extent that you are guaranteed to never have that person do that behavior again, for sure. But in terms of actually punishing the individual who did the crime, I don't know. I don't see how that makes sense.
I'll ask you the same question. If a person commits a crime, what should the consequence be?
That's interesting. Yeah, you brought that up earlier. To me, I really try hard with my kids to emphasize natural consequences. And that's hard sometimes because the natural consequences, for example, I have two teenagers who are living in my house, right? They like to stay up late and they like to be on their phone till whatever hour, and then they have to get up the next day. And when they get up the next day, if they have school, they get up dragging and they're tired. And then they go to school and they're dragging and they're tired and they don't learn anything. Well, the natural consequence of staying up late, which I don't want them to do, is that they are tired the next day and can't function, can't engage in what's going on in their day. But they don't care about that because they're at school and it doesn't matter to them. So that natural consequence doesn't work out. So sometimes the natural consequences don't serve the purposes that we need, and we need to insert some other consequences in some situations to help guide behavior. But I personally, Colin, we've talked about this before. I try with my kids, and I believe very strongly in trying to communicate the higher intent. And this goes back to our discussion in the last podcast about letter of the law versus spirit of the law. I'm very much about spirit of the law. I'm very much about intent. This is what we want to achieve. This is what we're trying to do. And here's why. Here's why that's important. Here's why it matters. And I tie that explanation to some natural consequences. For example, I let these kids know that if they don't communicate with me and I find out that they're somewhere that they shouldn't be, they've broken my trust. And what comes with broken trust is that I can't now give them the freedom comfortably that I gave them before, because that's the natural consequence that comes from breaking trust. And I try to tie the natural consequence of not engaging in the types of behavior that meet the intent that we want to the natural consequences that hopefully are relevant and matter to them. So what you asked is, to me, a really important question. Should we impose consequences at all? Should punishment be a thing at all? Should there be artificial consequences that we as a society just come up with that we impose upon people for certain behaviors? Or should we try as hard as we can to allow natural consequences to reign with the philosophy of people make mistakes and we want them to do better next time?
If someone's stealing something, the only way it's a natural consequence if they get caught and they get their ass kicked. That's a natural consequence. Your kids staying up late, that's not a crime. There's no crime in them staying up late besides them being tired.
Well, no, but the stealing thing is only a crime because we as a society decided that it was.
Yeah.
Staying up late could be a crime in my house because it's breaking the rules. We as a society created a rule, and when people break that rule, we've decided to use the word crime. When our kids break our rules, they're doing the exact same thing. We just tend to not call it crime. We just call it breaking rules. But it amounts to the same exact thing. But I get your point. When somebody steals something and they get caught, the natural consequence, I don't know what that would be for them unless there's some sort of artificial consequence that we put out there that's designed to minimize that behavior. And really, it comes down to both in my mind. Yes, there should be a consequence for engaging in that behavior. But in my opinion, I think that there should be a lot more effort on people's parts. And this is parents, teachers, coaches, anybody who deals with kids, or bosses at work, even managers, people who have relationships and rapport built with others, to try to hit things on the front end by explaining, here's the virtue that we're trying to live up to. Here's the value that we're trying to embody. And why? Here's why we're trying to live this way. Here's the benefit of that. And if you can teach people that and they understand where it is that you're going, why you want them to go there, why it's important, then you can hopefully minimize the behavior you don't want from the front end, like that. You provide that information up front, and you've still got some consequences on the back end in case the front end didn't take. Maybe a both and approach. I think we as a society have probably focused a lot more on the back half than we have on the front half. So maybe that would be a place to spend a little time.
I think, as you're saying, it comes down to values. If we as a society valued not stealing other people's things, we all have the same five basic needs. They are oxygen, water, food, shelter, and sleep. But then beyond that, we end up buying things in a consumer society. And then there's the mentality that a lot of our societal members have, that it's okay. I'm morally justified. I can still sleep when I go and steal people's things off their porch when they worked and paid the money for them. But that's okay because I'll take it. Additionally, think about identity theft. I'm going to take this person's credit card number. I'm going to charge this stuff. In 2020, I think there was $56 million lost in identity theft. In 1 year, $56 million. That's people stealing $56 million from other people in the country. That's so fucked up, dude. How do we change that? We try to change it with punishments. We try to change it, make it crimes. But it's bigger than that. It's a mentality.
It is. And it's the values you're talking about. I would be interested to, maybe once we get off of here, I'll try to find the statistics on differences between types of societies. So we live in an individualist culture, and there are collectivist cultures, like the Eastern cultures, Korea and Japan, and some of the Far East cultures tend to be more collectivist cultures. And I wonder what the rate of crimes like that, crimes against other people, like stealing, are, if there's a difference between individualist and collectivist. And the reason I say that is because one of the natural consequences of stealing from somebody else is now people don't trust other people. And if we're in a society, trust is everything. Because like you said, we all affect each other in ways we don't even know, but we can't help but do, because we all live together. We're all functioning together in this group. So when we can't trust each other, the second, third, fourth, fifth order effects of that can be dramatic. So it does come down to really communicating to people the importance of trust and having them buy into the importance of other people and their role, that we aren't separate from others, that we are actually connected in meaningful ways to those around us, even those people we steal from. So if we choose to steal from these people, that we're stealing from our group. And that's a big change in mentality because, again, like I said earlier, the United States, independence, freedom, these are things that people really rally around. These ideas that I have my property and my things and I am a person and I am free to do my whatevers. And with that being the primary value, then it does kind of become about, well, if I don't like you or I think you're whatever, then I don't mind taking things from you. And I can justify it, kind of like we were talking about in the first podcast too, the self-justification. I can justify that very easily, or more easily, I guess, in the individualist culture than I could in a collectivist culture. That would be interesting to look at. I don't know what those crime numbers would be.
There's something about statistics that just give us a little bit of a guide into human mentality. So I think statistics are such a valuable asset. But beyond statistics, there's a humanistic side of how people interpret it. If you look at just our political system, like you can use numbers to spin off any mindset or mentality. How do you interpret those statistics with values that help society go further or progress into a better human experience? I think it'd be great to, like you said, to find those crime statistics and then to put them against what the overall societal consciousness, like you said, individual or collectivist cultures. I think, as we talked before, there's a way for the individuals to stay individuals and thrive and take into consideration the society or the family that's around it. Like, we don't have to be either or. We can be both. If we saw each other as both, then that would affect how we interact with each other. What you were saying about how our actions affect us inversely because of the community or the society we live in, think about all the emails we get, like all the spam emails or all the fraud emails. Like, I don't know how many a day I get, but maybe 10 sometimes. Maybe a slow day is 2. Maybe a heavy day is 20. It's like the people who are putting these out are still going to be affected by getting them. It's like they're hurting themselves and also the people around them, their whole family. Someone that put out, say, a spam email to try to get some sort of money. And I can't imagine how their friends or family has never been affected by identity theft or some sort of fraud or some sort of credit card thing. It's like you're perpetuating a system that ends up hurting the people that you love, but somehow they're able to justify it.
Yeah, but Colin, they justify it because everybody's doing it. So if everybody's doing it, then I got to do it too. And that can be from a benefit standpoint. If everybody else is doing it, then I'm going to do it. If everybody else is getting some goodness from this, why am I going to get left out? You know, yeah, it might be wrong, but if everybody's doing it, then whatever. I'm not going to end up in last place just because I don't want to engage in this behavior. Or the other way around, which is everybody else is doing it, so I need to make sure I do it in order to stay safe. So this is kind of the gun thing. Everybody else has got a gun. Guns are everywhere, so I got to have a gun too. It's that same mentality.
I wish we had a different mentality about that.
It all starts here, dude. It all starts with one person. It starts with one person talking to another person. Because like we said before, a society is just a group of people. It is a group of individuals. And like you just said, if we can recognize that we are individuals who also reside together on this planet Earth, on this country, this continent, this United States, in our towns, we're just groups of people living together in ways that influence us. We are still individuals. Your salad analogy that you brought up in the last podcast, I thought was perfect. You know, I might be a tomato in the salad. You're a crouton in the salad. Doesn't mean the tomato is more important than the crouton. We're all important together because otherwise the salad wouldn't be what it is. So that mentality is, it does. It starts one person at a time. It starts one conversation at a time. And that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy talking to you on here. But we have talked, dude. We've talked for a long time. I think we've done it. I think we've solved all we can solve for this time around. My brain hurts.
What do you think that you've taken away from our discussion so far today?
Well, I don't know. The thing that really stuck with me about the death penalty and death threat conversation was what I brought up before. It just hadn't occurred to me before, is that they truly are the same thing, but one is legally sanctioned and one is considered a crime, but they're there for the exact same purpose. I am genuinely confused about the purpose of the death penalty. It's one of those issues that I think people are for it, they're against it, but I don't know what it is. I'm not sure that people aren't just talking past each other because they're defining things differently. They assume that the death penalty is helpful because it is a crime prevention tool. I don't know if it is or not. I think that would be interesting to look at. Or the death penalty is useful because it is the ultimate penalty to pay, your life. And so therefore you are sacrificing your life and that means something. And so you personally need to be punished for how bad what it was that you did. Or if it's a financial consideration, I don't know. I think that sometimes people's arguments for or against may not be articulated as clearly as they could be. And it really matters because why you think the death penalty should happen or not, it's not the same. If I think the death penalty shouldn't happen, in other words, my reasoning for that might not be the same as your reasoning for believing that the death penalty shouldn't happen. So we might be arguing on the same side, but in completely different ways, not saying the same thing at all. And then if I'm talking to somebody else on the other side saying the death penalty should happen, if I'm arguing my point and they're arguing their point, but we're not actually arguing the same things, they're just talking past each other. I thought that that was an interesting part of the discussion. What about you, man? What'd you take away?
Kind of the same thing about the death penalty, where I don't know which side of the line I'm on. I feel the same way you do about just the questions around the death penalty, the reasons for it or the reasons against it. I don't know if our discussions led me one way or the other, but I definitely have a broader understanding of what possible motives are. And I'm trying to understand the mentality of people that do death threats, people that do porch pirates that steal other people's packages. I would love, as we discussed, if our society was able to be in a way that we didn't have to impose such penalties because these crimes wouldn't happen. I liked your way of natural consequences, because everything does incur consequences. And I think it's important to take the responsibility for that. But the system we have has been a great system. It really has. But maybe there's a better system out there. And just because we've done it one way doesn't mean that's the way we should keep doing it. I guess that's what I've learned.
I don't know that I can get on board with you that it's a great system and has been a great system. I think it's been a system, and I think that it's prevented anarchy, but I think it's also sowed a lot of confusion and angst, and just because of the complexity of all the laws that are out there and the system itself and the mixture of politics. And but that's a whole nother conversation in and of itself. But it's interesting that the for or against the death penalty, there's something I didn't bring up in this conversation because I think it'd probably be good for another podcast, is this idea of free will. Do we actually have free will or don't we? Because there have been really good cases made by some really smart people that we don't have free will, that we actually live in a deterministic universe. And if we don't have free will, then the point of retribution, for sure, like punishment as a retributive tool, is it makes no sense because people aren't responsible ultimately for the choices that they make. I know that sounds weird because we talk so much in this country about our choices and all the things that we can choose. And to some degree, we do make choices, but those choices tend to be more constrained than we recognize. And I don't want to get into it now, but my whole point is just that there has been a very good case made for determinism, for the fact that there isn't free will. And if we don't have free will, then the way that we look at people who commit these crimes should change, because they're a product of their environment. They're a product of their genes. They are a product of things that they didn't control, that they didn't create. And that amalgamation of all of those things has resulted in this behavior that they've engaged in. And it's a bad behavior, and it's a wrong behavior. And it might even deserve some sort of punishment or removal from society just for the protection of everybody else. And that can all be part of the discussion. But the point is that ultimately, if people aren't responsible for their actions, their behaviors, then punishment from the standpoint of retribution, of vengeance, yeah, I mean, that person did it and they deserve to have this bad thing happen to them, doesn't make sense. And we would get further by having a more empathetic perspective of taking the outlook of trying to create different environmental conditions for this individual that can help shift them into a different way of thinking and make other behaviors much more likely to happen in the future. So I just like totally opened the box of free will, and it's a huge discussion. And I didn't mean to do that. I just wanted to bring it up in terms of the death penalty because it's relevant. If you believe the death penalty shouldn't happen, one of those reasons doesn't necessarily have to be the sanctity of life. It can also be, I don't believe that the person is ultimately responsible for his or her behavior because the person isn't responsible for his or her gene. And the person isn't responsible for all of the environmental factors that have influenced that person and contributed to the wiring of that person's brain and ultimately led to, in a deterministic fashion, the thought and behavior that we witnessed.
Free will, huh? You're just going to drop that bomb right on the end. Drop that bomb. I have many thoughts on that. However, let's save that discussion for another time, because I kind of feel like we could go to blows over that, right?
I don't know about blows, but it is something that requires more time. I'm with you. So your decision, your choice, your free will in action right now is that we're not going to talk about it now. We'll talk about it later. That's what you're that's what we're going with.
Yeah, my free will. I'm choosing that. I wasn't predetermined for that course of action. I chose that, my free will.
Okay, I will still say that at that point in time, you could not have chosen otherwise because we live in a deterministic universe. But more later on that. What do you got, Colin? Wrap us out of here.
Wrap us out. Well, thank you for listening to our third podcast in Poking Holes in Blinders. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Spotify and Podbean. Also, we have a website, pokingholesinblinders.org. And we always like posting something on Facebook. What you got, Brian?
I just wanted to put it out there again. You can find me as well with the performance psychology stuff at beginagainperformancepsychology.com for athletes or performers, singers, dancers, actors, musicians, stunt people, whatever your level of performance is, whatever your genre is. We work with a wide variety, and I'd love to talk to you. And don't forget the book, Begin Again, Utilize the Wisdom of Eastern and Western Ideologies to Achieve Your Full Potential. Check it out. It makes a great gift as well. So thank you very much for listening.
I kind of wanted to surprise this with you after a year, but I've been reading your book, and I've been doing the read something, wait a night, read something else. And I would love to have a discussion about that with you later on. Not now, later on.
No, I appreciate that, man. I'd love to have that conversation. That'll be a fun one.
It is fascinating. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to Poking Holes and Blinders, where knowledge infused with compassion fuels better decisions. Later.